Okay, well, thanks to all of you for joining us tonight, and welcome to the June 2024 edition of the DMSC Masterclass. This monthly class is for current DMSC students, faculty, and actually anyone interested in the Doctor of Medical Science program at the Arizona School of Health Sciences, A.T. Still University. We have an opportunity here from inspiring masters in the PA profession and in healthcare who have really made a significant impact. So before we begin, a few reminders. Please keep your microphones muted and feel free to share any comments or questions in the chat section during the presentation. We will have a Q&A session at the end where you can unmute yourself, and Dr. Beth Popray, our program manager, will be monitoring the chat for any questions or comments. But I've been looking forward to this evening. It's a pleasure to introduce our guest tonight, Stephen D. Wilson, PAC, who has a distinguished career in surgery spanning over 45 years. Steve's journey into the PA profession began at Alderson Broaddus College. We'll talk more about that, where he was introduced to the newly established PA program. His career in surgery took him to many hospitals and roles where he's made a significant impact on the profession. Steve also has been actively involved in professional service, contributing to organizations such as the Pennsylvania Society of PAs and the American Academy of PAs. And his dedication to the profession has earned him several prestigious awards in recognizing his lifetime achievement and service. So, Steve, welcome to our master class.
Thank you, Randy. It's a pleasure to be here. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, we're certainly eager to hear about your experiences in the PA profession, particularly your early entry into PA school back in the day, as they say, and clinical practice and your longstanding involvement in surgery. But let's start off with how in the world did you get involved in this crazy profession at the very beginning? And then talk to us a little bit about PA school.
Sure. I look back now and I look back at starting at Alderson Broaddus, and I've pretty well convinced myself that I was part of an experiment at that time. Because, most PAs back in that day, they were all ex-corpsmen coming back from NAM. Duke based their program on corpsmen and so forth. And there were a lot of, about half of my class were all corpsmen. But because it was the first four-year degree program, I think they wanted to see if they could take somebody right out of high school and turn them into being a PA. Now, I don't really know if that's what they were trying to do, but basically that's what happened. I was actually, Alderson Broaddus was a very innovative, small four-year program in the hills of West Virginia. There was a family there, the Myers family. About six or seven of them siblings were all physicians. They were all heavily invested into the community. They wanted to make sure that healthcare was available to this rural community in West Virginia. They had the Myers Clinic downtown that offered all kinds of specialty services. And they had Broaddus Hospital up on the hill on the Alderson Broaddus campus. And that's where Dr. Hugh Myers operated, and he actually trained residents from West Virginia University there. He came up with this idea because of everything that was going on in those days with the developing PA programs, that because they had already made sure that Alderson Broaddus had a four-year degree nursing program, a four-year degree rad tech program, a four-year degree med tech program, and they thought that a four-year degree PA program would really cap things off for what they were trying to do for healthcare in that area. And so they got the financing for it and finally got it started. I was the second class, second full class, I should say, that went to the school. I was actually headed to the rad tech program, and I, as you mentioned in your write-up, I got a call from the admissions department and said, "Hey, look, if you think you might like medicine, we got this brand new program going on called physician assistant." And I'm like, "Well, that sounds interesting." I recalled that when I was in high school, I had a physiology class. I really liked it. I thought, "Well, this could actually work for me pretty well." So I looked into it a little bit more, and then of course the icing on the cake was they said, and the government's giving grants for this. And I said, what does a grant mean? And it said, that means you get to go to school and be educated, and whatever money they pay for your education, you do not have to pay it back. You know, this was, you know, back in the Johnson administration, and they were trying to make sure that they could turn out PAs that would go into rural communities and serve with the physicians there in the health shortage areas. So I took advantage of that and got started. Now, AB was a primary care program. I mean, just like all PA programs, it had to meet the same standards as all everybody else, and the emphasis was going into primary care. But let's face it, Dr. Hugh was a surgeon, so there was a bit of a bias to that, I would have to say. We started out our first year in the process. We not only were taking science courses like chemistry and biology and the usual stuff that you would expect, but the first year, for instance, I had to take a class in the history, philosophy, and ethics of medicine. And also in the first year, in the first semester, I had to attend the grand rounds every Saturday morning at 8 o'clock at the hospital. And the grand rounds were, generally speaking, a surgical forum. There was a lot of surgical cases presented at that forum. And then after the grand rounds ended, which was around 9, 9:30, you had to go to the hospital and you had to make rounds with one of the physicians that had been at the conference, and you would trail around with them. You had no idea what you were looking at or hearing or anything else, but you were getting the exposure from day one. And as you can imagine, for a college student getting up and being at a conference at 8 o'clock Saturday morning, it could be rough at times, but it was also very, very rewarding. Early on, I attached myself to Dr. Hugh. He was just such a gentleman and such an instructor and so patient in teaching. I was just enthralled with the way he did things. And I got to the point along my career where I would check to see if he was operating, and then I would check to see if anybody was supposed to be with him, and then I would try to get myself invited into his surgical suite. It just really connected with me. And we had one semester between our freshman and sophomore year that we could go back home, and I did that between my freshman and sophomore year. And I ended up getting a job as an orderly, and I was working in a small hospital near my hometown in West Virginia. And it happened that they had one general surgeon there, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Tell. And Dr. Tell was actually the general surgeon that set my arm. There were no specialties in my hometown. So when I was 11 years old, he's the one that put my bones straight. So he was the only surgeon still at the hospital. And I worked as an orderly, and I was taking care of a lot of his patients on the floor post-op. And finally, I got up the nerve and I said, you know, I'd really like to come down and watch you operate on my days off. And he said, sure, why don't you do that? Now, this next part, hospital administrators now would just pull their hair out. But during the course of the summer, on my days off, with no coverage for anything in the hospital, I was going into his operative suite. They taught me how to scrub in, and by the end of the summer, I was assisting him on operations. I can't imagine that happening today, but as you could well expect, that kind of sealed the deal for me in terms of where I was headed. Of course, I completed the PA program like everyone else. Went out on the rotations and did everything that, you know, was supposed to do. But when it came time to decide on where I was going, Dr. Hugh encouraged me, basically. Dr. Hugh encouraged me to stay in surgery. And so I did. I'd been looking at, I was actually, if you recall back at the time, one of the hot jobs then was going to work on the Alaska pipeline. As a PA, and they'd take you and you'd be a month out in the wilderness and a month back home. I actually looked at that, but I just couldn't get surgery out of my head. So my first job and my last job were all in surgery. I did want to say one thing about my time in school and the impact of the vets that I worked that I went to school with. I think they made me a better student and they made me a better PA. And Randy, you know this as well as anybody. And I would just like to say if any of your students haven't gone to the PA history site and read your biography, they should do that. They need to do that. But the vets really they had seen what the worst that the world had to offer, especially those that had been in Nam. And when they came back and started going to school, they were looking to better themselves and do something better for mankind. And they were driven. And if you wanted to keep up with them in the classroom, you had to work extra hard. So I think having the veterans in my class really paid off for me down the road in terms of being focused and getting a good education along the way.
Wow, that's great. Well, you've received, numerous awards and accolades throughout your career, highlighting your contributions to the profession. Talk a little bit about, early on in your career, you decided to get involved. Let's start off with the state chapter with PSPA. Well, why in the world did you get involved, with your state organization? What contribution did you make, and how was that valuable to you?
Sure. My involvement with, of course, my first job was in Maryland, actually. When I graduated in 74, I went to the Shock Trauma Center at University Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Worked there for 2 years until I was totally exhausted, and then took a break and I thought, well, I'll try academia. And Essex PA program was combining with the Hopkins program at that time, and they agreed to hire me as their clinical coordinator. I did that for a couple of years and realized that I needed to go back to the operating room. And it happened that one of the surgeons I'd worked for at the trauma center was now in practice in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, about an hour outside of Pittsburgh. And wanted me to come up there and do general and trauma surgery with him. So I did that. And one of my classmates, a guy by the name of Joe Verano, who was in the first class from AB, was president of Pennsylvania Society at that time when they were trying to get the legislation passed. Of course, he found out I was moving into the state and he gave me a call up and said, "You've got to be one of the guys that helps us." So that invitation, knowing Joe, I jumped right in. And I think that early on, I began to realize that if you don't do something, especially at that time in our profession, if we didn't do something active, that if we didn't participate in what was going on and trying to deal with the legislation that was being developed and the rules and regulation that was being developed, it could be a very difficult career and maybe not as rewarding as we would want it to be. And I think that also there was a camaraderie there. I mean, I was working with a lot of good, great guys. I'm sure, Joe Verano, Bill Hunt, Dave Bissonette, Ron Fisher. I mean, these Bert Simon, of course. I mean, there were a lot of great guys from Pennsylvania that were dedicated to getting this all done. And we kind of fed off each other. I mean, we debated each other. One of the things that I learned in my term as president of the society, Pennsylvania Society, and as a legislative coordinator, was I set out there. I had 10 rules that I made in regard to legislation, and one of them was there was no such thing as a legislative emergency. You had to get your ducks in a row. You had to get people committed. You had to discuss what it was you were actually trying to pass, and you had to show up for the meetings, because if you didn't show up for the meetings, then they would do things that you didn't want. So we had a lot of good debates and among the group, and we didn't always agree, but we got things worked out. And what really helped along the way was that we could, I never wanted to go to a meeting when I did, where I didn't know the answer to the worst question they could ask me. When you go sit in a room with a bunch of legislators and everything, and they start asking you questions, you have to be prepared for giving them answer no matter what the question is. And I think all of that is just kind of empowering. It's educational. I think it had a great deal to do with how much I was able to change things in the clinical settings where I worked, in the hospitals and so forth. I could carry that knowledge back to the local level. It allowed me to network with a great number of individuals, and it was just as rewarding for me as I hope it was for the rest of the profession, for sure. And I just felt like I needed to pay it back because it's done so much for me. I mean, it's just amazing, and my career and what I've been able to do clinically is all due to, somebody stepping up and trying to get something done legislatively or in the hospital on the boards and so forth.
Yeah, I know that in the early part of the profession, when I first started, a lot of the leaders, were from Pennsylvania, many of the names that you just talked about, and many of them, graduates of AB. And of course, really the thing that happened with those folks as well is started getting involved in the AAPA House of Delegates. Talk a little bit about the House of Delegates. In fact, you may not remember this. We both ran for secretary one year for the House of Delegates. You won, and I was thankful for that, and I got my opportunity later. But talk a little bit about being involved at a national level. I mean, being involved at a local level makes a lot of sense, but to take the time and effort, and it took a lot of time in those days, to be in the House of Delegates and to be a leader. So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. First off, I think you have to have a very understanding wife if you're married to do all of these crazy things. I mean, it there is a lot of time involvement. There's no question about it. So that's number one. But beyond that, again, what the involvement with the national allowed me was to understand a much bigger picture than just what was going on in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, or in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where I lived at that time, during that time period. I could see what was going on in other states and how other states handled similar problems, how they got better privileges in the hospital, how they were able to finally get their prescriptive privileges completed and so forth and passed in the state. Pennsylvania was, our law was passed, I think it was 1978. And it gave us prescriptive privileges, but we weren't allowed to prescribe until the 90s, till the mid 90s. It took that long to get somebody to agree to the rules and regulations. So, it was a persistent effort that and it was time consuming, and it took a lot of people's time. But we used things to get it passed that we had seen on the national level, and we had a lot of input from AAPA staff. You're going to be talking to Ann Davis in a couple of weeks, I think. And just a wealth of knowledge about what was going on in other state legislatures, and was very helpful in trying to get that. She and Nicole Guerra were really big in the legislative arena at that time for the Academy, and really provided us with a lot of information. So the Academy really provided me the opportunity to gather all this information and not make the same mistakes that other people had already made. I mean, what it came down to. But it also, the Academy gave me a place to debate. You know, I remember when the big issue in the House of Delegates was, do we accept Medicare's invitation for reimbursement for PAs assisting at surgery before we get the whole package where Medicare would reimburse for all PA services? And you know, people wanted to hold off and wait and get the whole package, that it was unfair that the PAs doing surgery would get paid by Medicare, but the primary care PAs would not, and so forth, and you know, back and forth, back and forth. Those debates were lively. But what was neat about it was that we could debate as hard as we wanted in the House of Delegates, and when the House was adjourned, you know, we could go to the bar and sit down and have a drink, or we could go to dinner together, and there was no hard feelings. There were just differences of opinions, and I think we were all galvanized by the same issues. We had different ideas of how it needed to be done, and I think the House allowed us to sort out what is the best path for us to take. And of course, the issue that I talked about, we decided to take the reimbursement for surgery, and then soon thereafter, we were able to get reimbursement for all PA services.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point. Having been in the House myself for many years, you're exactly right. I mean, where can you go and have that kind of conversation, you know, with over 100 of your best friends, really? You know,
Right.
so that was great. Well, you know, Steve, we're fast approaching 60 years in the profession, and we continue in the House of Delegates to debate things. You know, so I want to talk a little bit about some of those things. You know, you're as a seasoned professional in the field. You know, what are your opinions, such as, you know, optimal team performance, or I'm sorry, optimal team practice, that the House and the Academy has really been pushing for the last greater than 5 years?
Well, Randy, first I want to thank you for giving me the softball questions early before we got into the hard stuff here. But I look at optimum team practice, and I think it's a matter of perspective, because in surgery, I've always felt I've had optimum team practice. You know, it's a different environment. I've been fortunate to be a part of surgical practices where they taught me and pushed me to the limit of my capabilities and knowledge, and gave me responsibilities that I never had envisioned that I would end up accepting along the way. Certainly, the surgical aspect itself, you know, our heads are about 8 inches apart when you're standing over somebody's chest. And I never felt like I was being supervised, which I guess is what people, you know, don't want to get away from. You know, I had a worked with one cardiac surgeon, and I'd been there about 2 years, and I said, you know, when do I get my evaluation? And the surgeon replied, as we're working, I evaluate you every day. And if I don't like what you're doing, I'll tell you. You know, so the idea of optimal team practice, optimum team practice, I felt like in my career, I had it the whole time. I think the other thing about it is that it depends on the physicians that you're working with. In my career, I have found that not only the physicians that I work with, but other physicians in the hospital setting, the ones that worked best with PAs and accepted what PAs were capable of doing and encouraged them to do more were physicians that were the most self-assured in their own capabilities and knowledge. And those physicians that fought us the whole time, I felt like weren't quite as strong a physician the PAs were working with. So I think when you talk about optimum team practice, you have to talk about the physicians that you're surrounded by. Because we have to face the fact, one thing that separates PAs from other healthcare providers, in the definitions in state legislation, PAs actually say, we practice medicine. Nobody else says that except physicians. Okay. So I think it's difficult for us to separate ourselves from physicians. And I think it's important that no matter what we do in the future, we have to maintain that alliance. I have been concerned that maybe the academy, the profession, didn't do everything that it could have possibly done to keep physician organizations on board with us and help us work out some solutions to the issues that do exist. I know that for my colleagues in primary care and the hospitalist situation and so forth, things have changed in that arena. There's no question. Physicians don't own their practices anymore for the most part. They're employees, and they're not getting paid to supervise somebody. So these are obstacles that had to be overcome. And of course, then there's a competition issue between PAs and NPs for these positions. I just wish we'd have tried a little harder at keeping that connection with physicians without it being too subservient. I think that the term that was used back when we started was that we were agents of the physician, if you remember that language. And I understand the necessity of getting away from that. But I don't think we need to say that we don't want anything to do with doctors. We don't want doctors looking over our shoulder. Because no matter what anybody says, and doctors look to other doctors. And when a PA gets in over their head, they're going to be turning to a doctor to help them out. So I think we have to maintain that connection some way while still making the advances that are necessary for better administrative utilization of PAs. I guess that's the best way to say it.
Yeah, I think you're right on target with that. And I too think that we as a profession could have done a better job of reaching out to our colleagues, our physicians, which sort of brings me to the next question, and that has to do with the title. As you know, the House of Delegates voted on changing it to physician associate. And it really passed to that because of the number of PAs at the House of Delegates that wanted to keep the term physician, in the title. And although others wanted it to be taken out. And as you know, Oregon just changed their society's name to the Oregon Society of Physician Associates. And there's a push to do that. But still a lot of controversy, and certainly from organized medicine. So, what's your thoughts about physician associate?
Well, my thought on this is pretty short. I have to be honest with you. All right. I think it's a huge waste of time and money to worry about that. I think there's some ego involved in the, in this desire to change it to associate. I don't care. I mean, if they want to spend the time and energy to do it, go for it. But it's been years since I've had to explain what a physician assistant is. I mean, I don't even have to say physician assistant anymore. I was told, well, of course, I retired after 48 years. I retired in 22, but at the end, the last 20 years, I just say I'm a PA, and they go, oh, my primary care person's a PA. I just think it was, I think we could have better utilized that money to figure out how to get better privileges in hospitals. I think we could have, I think there's a lot of institutions out there where PAs are still not on the medical staff. They're under allied health or whatever title that they come up with at the institutions. I think there are a lot of more issues out there for that PAs face that we could utilize that money that's going to be necessary in order to change state laws. I mean, it's no big deal to change the name of your organization. I mean, that's, you pay a legal bill probably to some attorney to get, file it. But I think we could have had better utilization of the funds, whatever it is that we spend for a title change. 10 years from now, it maybe physician associate will be the norm, and they'll still call them PAs.
Yep, right on target. And I understand it's over $1 million, to have
Oh.
that conversation. So, but anyway, I appreciate your short and sweet answer on that one. Let's move to academia for a minute. Over the last 3 or 4 years, the discussion about entry-level doctoral degrees, has come up. And in fact, over the last 2 years, the PAEA has had a doctoral summit each year. And in fact, this past year, PAEA decided and voted through their board of directors to not endorse a doctoral entry-level doctorate and to stick with the master's degree as the entry level. And I'm not talking about the post-professional doctorate. I'm talking about moving toward the degree that's given when you graduate from PA school as a doctorate. So have you had any thoughts about that? In terms of what the future may bring and how important it is. And again, I think the issue is everybody else, and their cousin is getting a doctorate degree now when they graduate. PTs, OTs, even athletic trainers are moving in that direction. So, what's your thoughts?
Wow. So we've already, are the ARC PA guidelines for PA programs going to change? Has there been any indication that they think that there needs to be something in addition to what the basics are for training a PA?
No. And in fact, they
Yeah.
say, Sharon Luke says, that ARCPA does not approve degrees, although they say that the degree ought to be
Right.
a, a graduate degree. But they say they approve programs and not degrees. And so the answer to your question, to my mind, is no, there won't be any changes, although a lot
So
of us would like to see some things change, but.
there, I'm sure there could be some changes, but to me, we proved that you can train somebody to be a PA in 4 years. And then we decided that, I'm not sure why we decided that a master's was going to be the level. You might know that history better than I do, but to me, it seemed like we were chasing nurse practitioners at that time because they were getting a master's. And now we're talking about a doctorate. Why are we adding it? What is it going to be? Two, three, four more years onto an educational process that we know only took four years to complete, and we've got a lot of PAs that are out there still that went to 4-year degree programs. We've got more PAs now from a master's level. They're all doing adequate clinical practice. So why are we going to add another level to this? Now, to me, the doctorate for a PA is going to be useful if they plan to stay in academia. I mean, you know that world better than I do. And but I'm well aware that if you want to move and within the academic process, you've got to have some kind of doctorate degree. I think if you're thinking about becoming a administrator, or start working in hospital administration or run clinics or whatever the case may be, I think probably getting some type of doctorate education is going to be very necessary. But at a time when we're talking about the huge debt that students are leaving college with, and people are trying to figure out how to pay it all off, at a time when schools are closing because they're having a hard time getting enrollment, I think I just don't under, I'm not quite clear on why we would want to make it an entry-level doctorate degree. I mean, if you're going to do that, why don't you go to medical school? I mean, that's an old argument, but really, it's the same amount of time. I don't, so I can't, I just don't, I can't rationalize it in my head. I think there's a need for a doctorate degree in certain situations, but I don't think it's something that every PA needs to obtain.
Well said. Well, so let's take it to the next level, and that's the excuse me, the doctoral degree, the post-professional doctoral degree. And obviously, this presentation is to the students in our DMSC program. And when we talk to our students and our graduates as to why they did it, it won't be surprising to you because you just said it. They do it because A, they want to move into academia, or be in academia and be able to move up a ladder in academic, academia, or they want to move into some leadership role, whether it's with Mayo Clinic or Cleveland Clinic or the military or the public health service. That really makes it give them a good opportunity. And number three, we hear, is they want parity with the nurse practitioners when they go out. And those are the three big reasons. The fourth reason is, that they get some more skills that's going to help them, in practice. So, but I guess my question to you is, what's your advice, to those people that have decided that they want to do a doctoral degree and to help themselves and to help the profession? What's your advice to our DMSC students?
So I think that they really need to focus on the administrative and leadership skills that can be gained by getting this advanced degree, taking advantage of that aspect of thing. Obviously, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, right? You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they're going to gain a lot of more clinical education. They're going to gain the ability to look at research. They're going to gain the ability to be involved in research, probably on any level, whether it's corporate research, with companies and so forth, or evaluate research as to whether or not it's suitable for their needs in clinical practice. I think those things are valuable, but I think the tools that they're going to gain in terms of understanding this brings up a good point. I'm going to stray here just a little bit, but stay with me, okay? Dr. Hugh Myers, one day in the hallway making rounds, he turned to me and he asked me a question, and I gave him a couple answers. And he says, "You're right." He says, "But the reason you're right," he said, "is because you've gained the mindset of the physician." And he says, "That's what's going to separate you from any other healthcare provider. You may not have all the knowledge that somebody that's gone to medical school, but you have the same mindset. And you're going to be able to figure out things along the way and gain knowledge and improve your capabilities as you move along. Obviously, coming out of PA school, one of the first things you learned is how much you don't know. And I think with a doctorate program that you're talking about, I think they can achieve the mindset of the positions that they're, the people that are holding the positions that they're looking to move into. And I think that's going to be the value of a postdoctorate program.
Yeah, well said. Well, I have two final questions, and then we're going to open it up for questions from other folks. But the first one is, Steve, you've, as you said, after what, 48 years or whatever it is, you finally retired in 2022. However, you're a past president of the PA History Society and a current trustee. Talk a little bit about your experience with the society and why it's important to learn about our history.
Well, I think I mentioned it early on. We don't want to make the same mistakes again. I mean, everybody says that, and it's kind of, trite. I mean, people bring it up and they say that. But for sure, I think we can learn so much. But the other thing that I've taken from my time in the History Society, and I've written a lot of biographies of different people, I think the one thing that the History Society can do is they can inspire people. If you start reading some of these biographies of people that are in the PA History Society or listening to the oral histories that are recorded, there is so much inspiration there. Where people came from, what they were able to do, what they plan to do, their successes. It's just, to me, it's just inspiring to read how wonderful lives these PAs have managed. And so I think it's not only recording what we've done, which is important. Everybody wants to know where you've been so you know where to go. But it's just the inspiration of these stories. One of the things that we're trying to focus on at the History Society right now is to get away from the idea that history is 40 years ago or history is 20 years ago. Okay, we've got that covered. I mean, those stories, that timeline, that's in there. The book that the society released is very detailed with all of that information, and I recommend it to anyone. But the history occurred last month. Some PA somewhere accomplished something that maybe another PA had never thought about doing, or it's never been done before with the profession. And we want to capture that history. Just for instance, we're talking about optimum team practice. We need to capture the history of that as it's going on, and what impact that is having on PAs today and tomorrow. So history is, for me, is more than 48 years ago. History for me is, last week or last month. And we need to capture that no matter what the PA is doing, no matter what their age is. They're
Excellent.
making history every day. We need to record it.
Well said. So my last question, Steve, is, now that you're retired, I know you're still busy. What do you do for fun?
Tell me.
Yeah.
Well, I've always been I like to do anything that's basically outside. I like to play golf. I like to hike. I like to go birding. I'm a bird watcher. And I'm one of those people that enjoys yard work. I can dig a pretty mean hole. And I need something to stick in there after I've dug it. So I enjoy that. And those are kind of my hobbies. Bike riding also. So I keep myself pretty busy. I move around quite a lot from one project to the other. It's taken me a while. I'm starting to settle into this retirement thing a little bit. I still feel like I need to get up and go do something every day. And I haven't quite kicked the habit of getting up at 5:30, 6 o'clock. So It's I got room for to do more for sure.
Well, that's great. And this wasn't on our list, Steve, but tell us a little bit about your family, kids, grandkids.
Oh wow. Yeah, I've got two great Pat, my wife Pat and I, we have two great kids, my daughter Marissa and my son Jared. They're both married. The worst part for us is that their families, I live on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, and my daughter live and her family, she has two boys. They live in Spokane, Washington. And my son and his two daughters and his wife, they live outside of Moline. Actually, they live in Iowa. So it's kind of a long journey for us to go see them. But they've all just brought us so much joy. It's just so much fun. My Marissa and Jared have just been a blessing to us our whole lives. And my daughter called me up today just to make me laugh, something silly that she'd done for the day. It's just very cool. So yeah, that's good. And I can't wait to see him again. We're trying to get ready to take off on another trip. The bad part is one time my daughter was living in Colorado and we flew out to see her in Denver, and my home here on the Eastern Shore of Maryland is 12 feet above sea level. We landed in Denver, and the next day she took us to Pikes Peak.
Wow.
There was a little bit of elevation change there. There might have been some altitude sickness. But we get to see them every chance we can.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for sharing that with us. I'm going to open it up for question now for anybody that has some questions for Steve. Just open up your mic or put a question in the chat and my bird, I knew you were going to open up your mic.
Yes, I did. Well, I don't have a well, I have a bit of a question, but mostly I just wanted to say how much recognition Steve deserves for all that he did for the Pennsylvania Society. A lot of the more recent graduates do not appreciate how tenuous our jobs were for a long time and how difficult it was to gain acceptance on a wider scale, especially with the wider medical community. And Steve was one of a very small group, and he was the leader of that group of people that did a lot of work for a lot of years. So he deserves a lot of credit for that. And question is, do you ever hear from Marvin Mokwin anymore?
Oh my gosh, Marvin, what a great guy. Marvin Mokwin was another PA that worked in cardiac surgery, and Marvin and I worked together in Harrisburg for 18 years, I think. And I just contacted Marvin recently, and he's looking forward to retirement this fall,
Oh,
November, I
good.
think.
Good.
Great guy. He was
Yes, he
just
is.
he's just a solid person. I enjoyed working with Marvin more than anybody else I've ever worked with. We were like brothers. It was pretty cool. And what's neat about Marvin, his son, he had one of his sons went on to PA school and is now working with Marvin in cardiac surgery.
Oh,
And
really? Oh.
in Harrisburg. Yeah, full
That's
circle.
great.
Great picture of he and his son operating together.
Oh. Wow,
Yeah.
very good. Great.
Yeah,
Thanks,
Marvin
Bert.
was with me when I've been fortunate to be involved in two cutting edge technologies in my career, and Marvin was right there with me at the time. Back in 1996, I went away to a place and learned how to do endoscopic vein harvest, and brought it back to the practice, and Marvin picked it up, and he and I actually became kind of competitive at who could do it, the best in terms of time and quality of vein. It had to be good quality. So we really spurred each other on. Of course, that technology now is state of the art, and that's common practice for cardiac surgery now. If you're not taking veins out with that technology, you're not keeping up. And then later on in Salisbury, this was a little off the topic, but we've started doing transcatheter aortic valve replacements, and they're doing more and more valve interventions through the groin and in the cath lab. One of the cardiologists and a cardiac surgeon and I started the program here in Salisbury for transcatheter aortic valve replacements back in, let's see, 2015, I think it was. It's probably longer than that now. I can't remember. But I was a clinical coordinator for that program, in addition to working in surgery. It's pretty dynamic. When I left, we started out, we did 12 in 1 year. And when I left, we were doing 125 a year. And they're probably still doing more. And now we started doing some mitral valve repairs and mitral valve replacements, transcatheter. So it's been an exciting career.
Wow. Anybody else have any questions for Steve? All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time this evening. Any last words before we close this up?
No, Randy, I just want to thank you for inviting me. I really do appreciate it. It's been great. I hope somebody gains something from this. If not, I still had a great time.
Well, I think both things will happen. That's it. So again, thank you so much. And thanks to all of you who attended today or will watch this later. Also, please join us next month on July 15th for our next masterclass with Rich Voss, also a trustee at the PA History Society. He's a longtime clinical PA, a PA educator, and a veteran, and we'll have a lot to share with us as well. So thanks for joining us today. The best to all of you. Have a great evening. Thank you.
Thank you. Enjoyed it. Good seeing you.
Good seeing you. Thanks, Steve.